Coming up on Golf Today, UCLA's own Patrick Cantlay doubles up at the BMW, becoming the first player ever to defend his title in the FedEx Cup playoffs. Is he the game's most underrated player? And Gig'em Sam Bennett of Texas A&M makes it through the gauntlet that is the U.S. Amateur with a big-time game and a message from his late father tattooed on his arm. And the golf world pays tribute to one of its own as Tom Weisskopf passed away over the weekend. We remember the man and his talent as a player and architect coming up on Golf Today.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
Golf Today on a Monday, Damon Hack alongside the great Jaime Diaz, a couple of California kids talking about the great game that we love. And speaking of California kids, Patrick Cantlay getting it done. I don't get to break this head cover out very often, but, you know, Pat Cantlay, they call him Patty Ice, as you know. When the getting is good, I bring out the old head cover, and we get to hear a little UCLA Bruin fight song on a Monday.
You're my favorite Bruin.
I am?
Yes, after Kareem.
After Kareem,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, pretty good.
Arthur Ashe, pretty good Bruin.
Also.
And how about Patrick Cantlay?
So many.
Pretty good Bruin.
That guy's rising up, isn't he?
Yeah, he loves the playoffs.
Yeah.
How about it?
Yeah.
He does, huh? The winner, Patrick Cantlay. You see the score. Final round, 69, 14 under for that one-shot victory over Scott Stallings. Look at Adam Scott. Gets inside the bubble, able to get it done and make his way to the Tour Championship. John Rahm playing well as well. Final round of 67 for the man known as Big Spain. And after his win, Patrick Cantlay spoke with our Kira K. Dixon.
Well, Patrick Cantlay becomes the first player to successfully defend a title at a FedEx Cup event. No dramatic playoff this year, but what does it mean to you to walk away with this win?
It means a lot. You know, today was a grind out there. The golf course was playing tough. It firmed up, and I had a lot of those mid-range putts and was able to convert pretty much all of them. After this year and the playoffs I've had, I'm glad to avoid a playoff today.
Take us through what the energy was like out there today. How much were you aware of where you stood on the leaderboard and the emotions?
Yeah, I definitely watched the leaderboard. And I saw that for the most part, guys weren't scoring too well. It was going to be, you know, a lot of pars and a lot of grinding it out. So I kind of adjusted my mindset, you know, in the first few holes because the golf course was playing a lot more difficult. And I hit a lot of solid shots, and to play, you know, the last five or six holes a couple under, I thought was really great.
Well, you have a chance next week to do something again that no one's ever done on the PGA Tour, which is win back-to-back FedEx Cups. How are you thinking about your game and keeping yourself ready and excited heading into that final week?
Yeah, I'm sure I'll draw on a lot of experiences from last year and just try and press the replay button. Although this year I'll be a couple behind Scotty, so it'll be a little different kind of a challenge. But East Lake's a golf course I really like, and I'm in great position, so I'm looking forward to the challenge.
Will you give yourself a chance to celebrate?
Maybe after next week.
All right, congratulations.
Thanks, Kira.
30 players with a ticket to ride. Tour Championship Atlanta, Georgia all begins on Thursday. You can watch it here on Golf Channel. Remember, the tour finale will begin under that scattered scoring system. So Scotty Scheffler, the world number one, and the FedEx Cup now number one as well, has a two-shot lead over Patrick Cantlay starting on Thursday. So where do you see this player with 8 wins on his PGA Tour resume now? Some big-time wins, 3 in the playoffs and 2 Memorial tournaments besides.
You know, he's got a great resume.
Underrated, maybe.
Perhaps.
Okay.
I think he gets credit for what he's done.
Okay.
Because he has got some great wins, but he has not correspondingly, you know, sort of assisted his record with majors.
Okay.
Or playing even that well in majors. For whatever reason, it's kind of a mystery. He's only got 3 top tens and 23 major appearances. For his abilities and what he's got done otherwise in winning on regular events, it just seems like a low ratio.
Mm.
So who knows if that's something that he is got a mental issue about, you know, right now that he's working out. I don't think so. He just seems so cool, but probably pressing a little in majors. But beyond that, he's just so solid. Throughout the game, we say this about a lot of players that are well-rounded. Nobody may be as well-rounded as Patrick Cantlay. He plays with finesse. He's got wonderful foundation. His teacher, Jamie Mulligan, talked about building a pyramid where the lower blocks are the most solid. And that's really what he's done because there's very little extraneous movement in his golf swing. You know, he plays with great rhythm.
Efficient. Is he the most efficient player in the game? I mean, so, you know, he's not, nothing's really flashy. 12th in strokes gained putting, 8th in strokes gained total. It just seems like he's an efficient golfer.
You watch the swing and it just doesn't have a lot of movement. It just looks like it repeats so easily. And the misses aren't that bad usually. Now, occasionally we'll miss a fairway, and maybe that's what's caught him in some majors. I don't know.
Yeah.
But he still has the abilities to make shots from difficult places and make up for his mistakes. So, and the putting stroke looks like he's going through that seasonal surge right now. It's getting hot. And when he gets hot with a putter, he can beat anybody anytime. He's always going to be consistent. The wins aren't going to come probably as prolifically as somebody with a superpower.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's very opportunistic, it appears. When he gets there, he usually puts his best foot forward.
He's also shown a great affinity, as you mentioned, for this time of year. He said one of the best shots he hit on Sunday was the fairway bunker shot on the 18th hole, 160 yards, ball above his feet, 8-iron. Jaime, he said he tried to hit a slice and swung as hard as he could.
That was a low margin for error shot, but when you're, you know, when you're in control of yourself and you have great fundamentals, you can do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he definitely, you know, rose to the occasion there. That's something that, you know, you dig in your memory bank for those when you're under pressure, and now he's got a lot of them now.
Speaking of memory banks, we thought it'd be cool to kind of show some of the great fairway bunker shots throughout time. Let's flash back all the way back to the year 2000. Canadian Open, 6-iron, Tiger Woods, 72nd hole, 218 yards, all carry.
This is a little classic. He did push it a bit. He did confess later.
He missed the green.
But it made it look even better. It looked like he was just flag hunting. So, you know, Tiger's one of the greatest fairway bunker players of all time.
How about
and
this?
Probably his greatest shot ever. Damon, take it away. I mean, 4-iron. Yeah,
I think it was a 3-iron, maybe. It was a 3-iron. This was the 18th hole. This is the 2002 PGA Championship. Ball below his feet. It's cold, into the wind. That ball landed like a butterfly with sore feet, and he made the putt. And, of course, earlier this summer, Matthew Fitzpatrick said he'd been struggling with his fairway bunker play. Did not look like it here.
That was a little bit of a mini version of Tiger's, because he had to, you know, cut it also from a kind of a side hill lie. But it came at the best time possible.
And you remember some others throughout history as well.
Well, you know, Sandy Lyle, of course, at 18 at the Masters in 88. And, of course, Seve at the 1983 Ryder Cup with a 3-wood from an uphill lie to a green 240 yards away. A lot of guys who saw that said it's the greatest shot they ever saw.
Yeah.
Jack and Tiger were, you know, not accidentally the greatest fairway bunker players, because Jack especially took so little sand. He just picked the ball perfectly with power, and he could hit it high with a long iron. He could take a 2 or 3 iron out of a bunker and still clear the lip. It was a great weapon, especially on par fives. So Jack, you know, that was a kind of an unsung dimension of his, when he really had to turn it on and show that he had something others don't. And actually, as a group, I think tour players, that's their biggest divide between the average player is fairway bunkers, because there's less margin for error.
Yeah.
You know, imperfect contact hurts you more in the bunker than anywhere else. And those guys just habitually make great contact. And when they do miss, it's usually thin.
Yeah.
Thin to win. They don't miss fat very often. We saw Scotty Scheffler do that a couple of times, and it hurt him. But usually
we saw Jordan Spieth.
It happens.
You know, tied for the lead. Mm-hmm. You know, Michael Grella tried to talk him out of it. By the way, I put a little more weight on my left side, just to, you know, for those at home keeping score. You know, a little weight on the left side. Charlie Reimer taught me that years
ball
ago.
First.
Ball first. Gotta contact. Ball first. I mean, you know, I'm not a great fairway
bunker.
Well,
you hit the baby
cut,
and that's a good swing for the bunker.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. Thank you very much. For more on this Monday, let's turn to Paige McKenzie. Paige, always great to see you. You watched Patrick Cantlay grind it out for that 8th win on the PGA Tour. What were your main takeaways from the final round?
Yeah, I mean, I like that you pointed out the 18th hole. You mentioned it. That bunker shot was really impressive. But I actually think what happened on 17 was maybe more significant. When Patrick Cantlay stood on that tee, he had just come off a missed fairway on 16. He'd come off a missed fairway on the 12th, and he'd missed it kind of wide right. So when this ball started tracking to the right, you're thinking, man, this is going to be difficult for a player to try to get a birdie. But what a lucky break. And he acknowledged it after the round, how important that was to not be in the rough, not be in the bunker, to give himself a good lie, because what he had left, what he had remaining, was only 65 yards on this 17th hole. And it gave him this opportunity to make the birdie that he needed to ultimately go ahead. And when I think about it, he was not strong with his wedges on that Sunday. He had 8 shots inside 125 yards, and starting at the very first hole, only 68 yards. And ends up missing the green. And so I'm thinking, for a player that throughout the day did not convert from short distance, to do what he did on 17 was even more impressive. You go to the sixth, or the 10th hole, excuse me, 120 yards. Again, doesn't even hit the fairway from the middle of the green. And there were a couple other wedges that he had throughout the day that it wasn't as ideal of conditions. Because he had missed the fairway, he put himself in more difficult positions, so it was impossible to take advantage of the short distance. This from only 112 yards, you're expecting to stick it close. But that was actually a pretty decent shot considering he was coming out of the rough. And then on the 16th hole, I mentioned he had missed this fairway as well. He only had 111 yards on the 16th, but again, was out of position, so not able to take advantage of the short distance. So when I think about how important the 17th hole, it was important because he put himself in position, because again, out of position, that was not a bad shot over the ridge to get to the top tier. Like, that was about as good as he was gonna do from 111 yards. But when he was in the fairway, he was up to his season average, which is not one of the best on the PGA Tour. And then out of the rough, still 25 feet, so another 7 feet on average for the week. That's not Sunday, but for the week, he would be further from the hole. So imagine that 17th hole, if he was out of the rough, out of the fairway bunker, not able to get that kick forward to get to 65 yards, what would have been different? So I'm going to give credit to the good bounce, but I'm also going to give it credit to the fact that situationally, when he had the most pressure, he delivered the best wedge shot of the day, the closest to the hole of the day on that 17th hole when he needed it most.
Great stuff from Paige McKenzie, and a reminder that even the winners on the PGA Tour don't hit perfect shots all the way on the way to hosting that trophy. All right, folks, the golf world said goodbye to a legend in the game last week. Tom Weisskopf passed away at the age of 79. We remember Tom's impact on and off the golf course. We say hello to his good friend Judy Rankin right after the break. Welcome back to Golf Today. 1973 Open champ Tom Weisskopf passed away Saturday evening after a long battle with pancreatic cancer. In addition to his victory at Troon, Weisskopf finished runner-up at the Masters 4 times in a span of 7 years. Illustrious career for Weisskopf, both as a player and a golf course architect. A list of some of his notable achievements: the 16 PGA Tour wins, including that 1973 Open, 4-time winner on PGA Tour Champions, including the 1995 U.S. Senior Open at Congressional, 1963 Western Amateur Champion, 2-time U.S. Ryder Cup team member. Notable course designs include TPC Scottsdale, Troon North, and Loch Lomond over in Scotland, and work as a golf analyst for CBS Sports, ABC, and ESPN. As you can imagine, the golf world sharing their love for Tom Weisskopf on social media yesterday. This from Tom Watson. A lot of us found out that Tom Weisskopf had passed away from this tweet. I send my deepest sympathies to the family of Tom Weisskopf. We'll miss you and your stories. Rest in peace, my friend. Pancreatic cancer has struck again. World Golf Hall of Fame member Annika Sorenstam, I'm so sorry to hear the passing of Tom Weisskopf. Thoughts and prayers to his family. Great talent on the course and second career in golf course architecture. Rest in peace. And the Scotsman Robert McIntyre, I'll always be grateful for what Tom Weisskopf has done in golf. Created the most spectacular golf course, Loch Lomond, and possibly my all-time favorite. And Gary Player, World Golf Hall of Fame member, sending my deepest condolences to Tom Weisskopf's family. Another great life gone too soon due to pancreatic cancer. Rest in peace, Tom. And Judy Rankin, so sad for the battle Tom Weisskopf went through. He was blessed to have Lori by his side. Working with him not so many years ago was such fun. Very talented player and architect. And the Hall of Famer Judy Rankin joins us on this very difficult Monday in the game. We appreciate your time. Judy, we knew Tom as the golfer, but you knew him as the person. What did you enjoy most about your friendship with Tom Weisskopf?
Well, I first met him when I was still a teenager playing the tour. And I didn't know him very well, but I first met him, kind of fascinated by Tom Weisskopf. He was quite the figure when you were 19 years old and you saw Tom Weisskopf. I remember some of the stories about his antics on the golf course, his terrible temper, and so on and so forth. But beyond that and beyond seeing him and knowing him a little bit through the years, when he came to work for ESPN, all the last years that we were doing the Open Championship, we had a great time. He was great company. We all made friends with his wife, Lori. And best of my recollection, his partner in crime on the air was Trey Wingo. And the two of them were amazingly funny and could really play off of each other. So we had an awful good time. And it was a group that included Tirico and Andy North and Scott Van Pelt and Curtis Strange and days that you can't get back again.
Judy, Tom was extremely, I thought, introspective about his career in conversation. He relived his career for you, you know, and there was some guilt, he said, at not fulfilling his potential or even remorse. I just wonder, do you feel like the players that are slightly or maybe a lot unfulfilled tend to make more insightful broadcasters?
I think you have to have been punished a little bit by the game to know the real core of what is playing competitive professional golf year round and year after year. I don't think you can be exactly as honest as you should be if you haven't had some hard times in the game and if you don't have some regrets. I'm always amazed at all the people who say they have no regrets. What a great thing. And I'm not one of those people.
He was honest about those regrets and the expectations and the comparisons to Jack Nicklaus, for example, following him to Ohio State. Did you ever see any of that weigh on him outwardly or with your time with him?
Not as he was older. No, he had gotten over all that. He had great appreciation for all the things that were right and good about him and golf. And he totally, he was very forthcoming about the things that he didn't do well in life, but he couldn't go back. And he was, I think he was being the best guy he could be all the last years of his life. And I don't mean the last couple of years, I mean all the last years of his life. And, the big mark that he's left for us is all these golf courses.
Yeah, you talk about those golf courses, Judy, and, you know, he was such an artistic guy and had a great appreciation for aesthetics. Obviously, his golf courses, the way he dressed. I just wonder what conversations were like with him at dinner. Were they wide-ranging? Was he like an eclectic person beyond golf?
I think he was a very, very intelligent guy. And, it's probably, and let me see if I can say this properly, it's probably that kind of intelligence that makes you know how good somebody like Jack Nicklaus was, that he knew in the back of his mind at all times that Jack Nicklaus was a greater talent than he was. And we all know that Tom Weisskopf did not live up to his potential. He knew that, but he had learned to live with it. And he loved the game in a wonderful way at the end. Tom, I never saw in the last years that I spent a fair amount of time with him, I never saw anything that would even resemble temper, nothing like it. But as I looked at all the golf courses today, I was amazed how many there were. And there is a word that came up, and he said, "I don't want to make a golf hole intimidating." And so I love that about an architect, maybe challenging, but not intimidating. And that's the kind of architect it seems like he was. And so we all appreciate that.
Well, Judy, when you consider his playing record, the major championship, the 16 PGA Tour wins, and couple that with his prolific resume as a golf course architect, can you make a case that Tom Weisskopf belongs with you in the World Golf Hall of Fame?
I'm going to tell you quite honestly, I made that case. I really tried to make that case, and I tried to make that case shortly after I knew Tom was sick. And there just wasn't enough support to make that happen. I'm not so sure. I'm sorry that it takes the passing of someone for people to celebrate what all they did that seems to matter to each and every one of us. And so he did a lot of things that matter to all of us in golf. So it's a shame that that's celebrated after he's gone.
I have to agree with you wholeheartedly. Judy, thank you so much for your time. It was a very sad Monday in the game. We hope to speak to you soon.
Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
And this statement from the commissioner of the PGA Tour, Jay Monahan. The PGA Tour is saddened at the passing of Tom Weisskopf, a towering figure in the game of golf, not only during his playing career, but through his accomplished work in the broadcast booth and golf course design business. Tom is leaving behind a lasting legacy in golf. The beautiful swing he showcased during his 16 career PGA Tour victories is still being emulated today, while his golf courses remain as testaments to his love for the game. Our hearts and deepest sympathies are with the entire Weisskopf family during this time. Jaime, how about the words of Judy Rankin that she campaigned and pushed for Tom Weisskopf to be a member of the World Golf Hall of Fame?
Unfortunately, you know, with death often comes more appreciation, which is sad because Tom would have loved to have been alive when he goes into the Hall. He will go into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I don't know if it'll be the next time. It'll be soon. And it's well-deserved. You know, 16 victories, one major, 28 victories worldwide. A true figure in the game, statuesque, you know, put his hands on the club and stood over the ball like no one else almost. It was just beautiful to watch. He had a real persona in the game, and he should be in the Hall.
And seemed to have found peace later in his life. In some ways, was he the most complicated star in this firmament of golf course, or golf stars, I should say, in the 1970s, you know, with Miller and Watson and Nicklaus. Yeah. Was he the most complicated?
I think everybody who plays the highest level is pretty complicated, but he might have been the most candid and the most introspective, and in some ways the most haunted, but in this almost endearing way that he admitted his flaws and studied them and regretted some of them, but also, as Judy said, came to peace with them. You know, he had a wonderful last hurrah at the 1995 Senior Open at Congressional. He played beautifully. Jack was in the field playing well. Tom beat him by four. We said he was so at peace at that moment. He had left some of the demons from behind. He used to feel like, when he was such a perfectionist, if he hit a bad shot, he wanted to start all over, tear the card up like an artist tearing up the canvas and putting up a new. You can't do that in golf. You got to keep going. And he just kept going beautifully at Congressional. You know, he was 53 years old.
But you were there for that.
I was there.
What do you remember about his game at that time?
Well, it was a big game. He hadn't lost very much at all. And he said himself, that's the best I've ever played. And that included Troon in 73, which really is amazing. But he was that kind of athlete. He endured beautifully physically. Mm. And he just had that classic swing that lasted. And he was a big guy, 6'3", 200 pounds. Just classic. And he just did so many good things, you know. And that introspection was beautiful because he had a great appreciation for the guys he played against, Nicklaus, Floyd, Trevino, Miller, Watson, all those guys. He said those guys were really tough guys to beat, and they were tough people, but they were really intelligent about winning. He goes, I lacked that. Mm. That's what I lacked. I learned it later. So I just felt like he was a student of the game in a way that gave you more than somebody who maybe was a little bit more fulfilled.
You love talking. I loved talking to him. I know you played golf with him at Loch Lomond.
One time,
Loch Lomond,
nine holes at Loch Lomond was beautiful. The years just fell by. It was like 2010.
Amazing.
But I did love talking to him. Just very quickly, Golf Digest did long interviews, and they started in 1990, and it was the best thing in the magazine for a long time. And the first one was Tom Weisskopf. And he set the bar for them. They weren't going to be as big as they were, but Guy Yoakam did such a great job with Tom, and Tom was so open that suddenly there's 12-page, 15-page interviews in Golf Digest because of Tom Weisskopf.
Big loss for our game. So talented, introspective, imperfect, sincere, human. Our condolences go out to Tom Weisskopf's family. He will be missed by so many in the world of golf. Take a look at the bio for Sam Bennett. Entered the week third in the WAGR, they call it, the World Amateur Golf Ranking. Two-time Ping First Team All-American at Texas A&M. But a good athlete, tennis player, basketball player.
Four letters.
I mean, that's kind of old school for the SEC Player of the Year. Two-time U.S. Arnold Palmer Cup team member as well. How about these two young men and kind of the roads they traveled to this moment? You know, Sam Bennett with the tattoo on his arm. You know, your father said, don't wait to do something. And yes, traveling home in style. But I just love kind of the homespun swing and also kind of the dedication to his dad.
Very inspirational.
Yeah.
I mean, just pure golf. These guys, you know, they're not the most gifted probably, but they're the most dedicated, the most grinding. They appreciated the moment. They really loved what they were doing yesterday. They knew how lucky they were. That may be the peak of their careers. Who knows? But it was really a beautiful moment. And I thought Sam you know, he's outwardly very cocky.
Yeah.
And maybe that is something that fuels him as he's playing. But he's also self-effacing because he's not ready to turn pro yet. He knows he's got to get better. And the same thing with young man Carr.
Ben, you know, yeah.
He's 50-year senior. He's going to go back to school for one more year. So these guys are works in progress, but they gave it their all. And that was, you know, what amateur golf's all about.
Yeah.
Love of the game.
And you know athletes, you've covered them for so long, that fine line between being confident mm-hmm. and cocky. And here's Sam Bennett saying, you know, hey, you know, there's a lot of great players here. They're great, but I'm the better player. I'm the dog.
Well, he had the rating. The ranking to support him. He's third in the world. But still, no, you don't say that usually.
You don't say it out loud. The quiet part out loud.
The quiet part out loud, and the game usually humbles with a backlash, a hard backlash when that usually happens. But again, I think he has that saving grace. And, you know, his opponents did not take offense. Mm. They really liked him. They felt like he's a great guy. He's confident. He gives it his all. I admire him. That came through, and you know, that tattoo, that spoke volumes, too.
How about the golf course speaking volumes as well? You've played Ridgewood, as have I. It's old line, old school. How important is it, you know, to win on a venue like this when you consider where the U.S. Amateur is going these days?
Well, I think the classic golf courses are made for the U.S. Amateur because they can get them really fast and firm, and there's just an art to playing match play that really comes through in the strategic part. And Tillinghast, my favorite architect, and Richard, one of his greatest works. I remember the 1990 Senior Open there where Lee Trevino and Jack came down the stretch, and you saw all the nuances of that golf course, and they got it fast and firm, and those slopes, those green complexes really told the story in terms of good approach shots compared to approach shots you couldn't get up and down because the green, they were missed on the wrong side of the green. So I just felt strategically one of the great courses, and the golf's more interesting when it's that way to me.
Yeah.
There's just more going on. Mm. There's more to lose with a bad shot. There's more to gain with a great shot.
They brought Trevino into the booth, and he, you know, he was watching Jack finish, and he said, Jack sometimes peeks at these putts, and he missed the putt. And Trevino famously said, give me that trophy. Give me that trophy.
That was the ruthless Lee Trevino who knew how to close. And, you know, Jack did have a little habit of that. In fact, Weisskopf was talking about it. That at the Masters in 86, he goes, oh, Jack finally kept his head down.
Absolutely.
So there was sort of a little moment when Jack didn't have everything going. Yeah. That was the smallest flaw of all.
Big week for Lee Trevino, big week for Sam Bennett this week at Ridgewood. All right, folks, still to come, the automatic qualifiers for both the President's Cup teams have been finalized. So we have an opportunity to kind of break down the 8 international and 6 American players to make up their respective teams. So please stay tuned. All roads lead to Atlanta, Georgia. First round coverage of the Tour Championship comes your way on Golf Channel Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. I think it's one of the most underrated golf courses that they play, by the way, every year. I mean, I love this venue.
I love this venue, too, and I also love the story behind it, what Tom Cousins did for the community, the way they improved the golf course, the way they made this, you know, just a paradise for tour players to get down there. And, you know, Atlanta, you know, in the late summer is not necessarily perfect.
Yeah.
But I think beyond that, they've just idealized the place in a way that I think it has now great tradition. And you think of the Tour Championship, you think of Eastlake.
Absolutely right. You see the 30 players tee it up starting Thursday. Scottie Scheffler, the world number one, the FedEx Cup number one, will have that 2-shot lead over Patrick Cantlay. But the question is, you know, who's the favorite? You saw the scores there. You like the staggered start, so should I just assume that Scheffler is your guy?
No, I think 2 strokes is not that much, so I'm going to go with Cantlay. And I just sort of feel that Patrick, he's reliving last year in a way. You know, this thing is kicking in the same way. Of course, golf's so capricious, you can never predict, but it just seems like he's such a steady guy and someone who is just so even in his temperament that he can put himself where right now it's just happening organically. He's in the same mindset as last year. I mean, he won BMW. He came out of there feeling great. I mean, he was so clutch when he beat Bryson in that 6-hole playoff, but he was just equally clutch yesterday.
Yeah.
So I just think that he's on a golf course, too, that it doesn't have to overpower. It is more about precision and accuracy, plays to his strengths, and an all-around game. You've got to hit shots out there because of the design is subtle. It doesn't have a lot of, you know, penal areas where you're going to make doubles, but a lot of places where bogeys leak away if you don't hit the ball, you know, in the right place. And I think that's his forte. And, you know, you don't think about Patrick every week, But when he's hot, you do.
Yeah.
And he's hot right now.
And it's interesting. He's one of those players, and you say athletes, oh, they say it's not about the money. He seems like someone, and he said it last year. Mm-hmm. He was almost like embarrassed by the amount of money that they were playing for. You know, where does that kind of fit in the equation? He's not going to go there, you know, gripping or worrying about whether or not how many zeros are at the end of this check.
It seems so long ago that anybody's spoken like that. You know, but I think
quaint days.
Yes,
right?
Quaint days. Yeah, and Patrick, even he was somewhat considered rumored, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So you never know.
You never know.
But I do think that he does play for the love of the game.
Yeah.
And he's been playing it a long time. He was the number one amateur in the world. He went through a crisis. I think he has reassessed why he plays. And he's got just a great perspective on the game.
Yeah.
You never see him get too excited and too up or too down. I think he just understands golf's got to be played with an even keel. And he does it in a way that I think he gets great satisfaction out of being consistent.
Yeah.
That's what he's really, you know, in his golf swing, in his temperament, and in his performance.
Sounds like you're describing Scottie Scheffler to a T. That's my guy who's the favorite. Yes, he has the two-shot lead. And, you know, having spoken to past world number ones, they don't like being threatened. They don't want to lose that. I've talked to John Rahm about that. I've talked to Jason Day about that. They want to grow that lead in the official world golf ranking. And I think that because of the close that Cameron Smith has had, that this is a great opportunity for Scottie Scheffler to kind of finish the year the way that he started it, with the win in Phoenix and on down, winning the Masters, now four-time winner this season. And I think that this is a great opportunity, much like Jordan Spieth, who was threatened by Jason Day in 2015 when he won the Masters. Then he got to hear the footsteps of Jason Day, and then Spieth said, no, the FedEx Cup is mine. I think Scottie Scheffler, coming off his first top 10 finish since the U.S. Open, doing that yesterday, I think looks very dangerous and comfortable going into East Lake.
I think Scottie has really held on to number one very admirably for a guy who had never been in that situation before.
Yeah.
I think he's risen to the occasion, and he doesn't talk about it very much, like he doesn't want to make that the priority. Mm. But I think there's the competitiveness there that burns.
Quiet. It's a
burns inside.
Right?
But even DJ, who we used to worry about motivation, he hated losing number one.
Yeah.
He would always play better when his back was against the wall. So I think number one, it's nice. I think that it's grown in importance as the game has, you know, moved on from 85 when they first started the ranking.
Yeah.
I think it means something to the players, and, you know, I think that extra motivation, which is something that is not always easy week to week, the number one position is something that gives, I think, those guys an extra amount of focus.
Let's bring back Paige McKenzie to see if she agrees with us or if she thinks we're talking nonsense. Paige?
I mean, you're definitely not talking nonsense when you're talking about the top two players on the FedEx list. But I would also like to throw Xander Schauffele's name in the ring. This is a player I talked about last week as a value pick in the odds. He was at plus 1,300 to win the FedEx Cup, and he did his job last week in climbing the board. He's now the third favorite on the board behind Cantlay and Scheffler, and it has a lot to do with how he plays East Lake. And that's big point that I was making last week, is that ultimately the FedEx Cup is determined by who plays East Lake best. And when you look at the players that have played it since 2016, no one has played it better than Xander Schauffele. And even if you were to compare Xander to Scottie Scheffler and the four-shot deficit he is going to begin with, he is nearly a full stroke better than Scottie Scheffler on this golf course every day. So that nearly makes up for, again, on paper, nearly makes up for the four-shot deficit that he will begin with. And when you consider the fact that he's bringing into this week a significant amount of confidence, giving the credit to the three wins on the PGA Tours this season, he's in the best shape that he's ever been in as it relates to confidence coming into the FedEx Championship, the Tour Championship. So I would never discount Xander Schauffele on this golf course. I'm looking forward to seeing him play.
Wow, Paige is having a very good Monday, Jaime. I mean, she brings up a great point about Xander's comfort on this golf course.
I'm a big Xander fan. I just feel like yesterday wasn't his best day.
Yeah.
Again, Sundays are the thing that he's still, I think, growing into as a closer.
Yeah.
So this would be a big moment to close this out as Paige is endorsing, and that's very possible. But I think right now that's the X factor with X.
Terrific insight from Paige McKenzie. We appreciate it. Xander, by the way, is going to be on the President's Cup team. The President's Cup just about a month away. Team USA will take on the international team at Quail Hollow, Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, yesterday, following the conclusion of the BMW Championship, we had the automatic qualifiers for both sides. They were actually finalized. So six automatic qualifiers on the United States. Scheffler, Cantlay, they're shot. There are three guys right there, and got Sam Burns, Justin Thomas, Tony Finau. What good guys. It's just a nice guy squad.
Nice guy squad, and also a bunch of real players.
Yeah.
That's a deep team.
Absolutely. So you got six picks coming for Davis, and then you got the International President's Cup, captained by our good buddy Trevor Immelman, 2008 Masters champion. You got Cam Smith, a little smoke rumor innuendo about him. Hideki as well. You got Sungjae, Joaquin Niemann. You got Tom Kim, as we call him, Joo Young Kim. You got Corey Connors, Canadian absolute ball striker. And Adam Scott. You got Mito Pereira,
yeah,
who had a great run at Southern Hills. So where are we here as we look at these teams that are, you know, starting to take shape, but there's a lot of unknowns, I would say, as we sit on this Monday.
Especially on the international side, obviously. And that's the difficult thing, because they're you know, they haven't got the record against the Americans,
yeah,
in the President's Cup. And they're playing away. They're playing at home on American home soil.
Yeah.
So the challenge even is greater with all this uncertainty. Now, maybe it'll loosen everybody up and they'll just go out and play with nothing to,
yeah,
lose. But, you know, culturally, that's always been an issue at the President's Cup, is getting unity, is getting everybody,
right,
on the same page. And you throw this curveball and perhaps a little dissension based,
yeah,
on people who are staying on the PGA Tour and going to live. And, you know, I think Trevor will have to use all his diplomatic skills, and we know he has a lot of them, to just keep everything unified. But, you know, I feel like, I hope the President's Cup doesn't lose energy or lose focus, just as a sort of a collective enterprise, because of this distraction. I hope once the competition starts, which it tends to do in golf,
yeah,
it gets heated. You know, people want to win, and that'll carry the competition. After that, we'll probably have all kinds of changes.
Well, I hope it doesn't get distracted too much. I think it's a Sandy Koufax curveball, as my dad would say, the ball rolling off the table. That's how big this
12-6
fracturing absolutely has been in the game. And Trevor already has had to use energy, mm-hmm, to talk about it. And T.I. has been very active on social media, mm-hmm, on Twitter, on Instagram, kind of, you know, being asked, you know, Cap, are you going to lose players? He's responding to a question about Cameron Smith, saying, all I know is I'm prepared. Last week, Cam said in his press conference that he's looking forward to the President's Cup. Until I hear different, I take him at his word. You know, we love the shield, the new logo, and part of what Ernie Els did was to kind of, despite the language barrier, give the international team something to play for, to rally around. But this is not the best, yeah, way to prepare going into the President's Cup, where you have to answer questions about who's going to be there, who's going to hold out, you know, how you know, much is Greg Norman trying to kind of distract from what should be a really good competition, considering the 16-14 result that we saw a few years
Greg
ago.
Greg Norman, who played in the first President's Cup, you
he
know,
did.
And it meant so much to him at that time. But this was unforeseen. You know, the international team has done a lot of great building year after year, President's Cup after President's Cup, to get more unified.
Mm.
And they're making progress. And
yes,
I would hate to see this undo it. I think this is sort of a one-off situation, and who knows how it's going to land.
Yeah.
But at the moment, I think it doesn't help the internationals, at least on paper.
Yeah.
It makes the Americans probably feel like,
yeah,
you know, we have a bigger advantage than we did before.
A little strange, though, let's be honest, not seeing a Koepka, a DJ, a Bryson.
True.
You know, it might be a little easier. Team might be, you know, more coachable. You don't have to worry about too many of the sideshow distractions. But, yeah, definitely going to be an interesting President's Cup 1 month from now. All right, folks, still to come on Golf Today. With 1 week left in the PGA Tour season, we thought it'd be a good time to look back at the best moments from the season that was. Let's reveal our favorites after the break. Back on Golf Today, so many great moments this season. First leg of the FedEx Cup playoffs was Will Zalatoris in the winner's circle. First time, the FedEx St. Jude Championship. What are they going to say now? I love that moment. A little ode to Steph Curry of the Warriors. Then yesterday, Patrick Cantlay defending his title, the BMW Championship. Caves Valley a year ago, Wilmington Country Club yesterday. I like that BMW logo. I'm kind of a car guy, and I like the trophy. Give it out, the BMW Championship. Been a great season, I think. 47 and final event comes up this week. 33 different winners. 9 players have won multiple times. 5 players, including Cantlay, have defended their title. We have 13 first-time winners. The youngest, Tom Kim. The oldest, Chez Reavie. So 1 week to go. That'd be fun to look back at our favorite moments from this PGA Tour season. Yes, our favorite moments. I believe Paige McKenzie has rejoined us. Paige, I want to start with you. Your favorite moment.
For me, it was Scottie Scheffler winning the Waste Management. WM. I am a Scottsdale resident, so there's ties there. But I think when you look back and you have hindsight into what this meant for Scottie Scheffler, this is his first PGA Tour win. It's hard to believe it's this season. To see a player go from a first win, then win three times more, including the Masters within a six-week stretch, and ascend to world number one, where he's managed to retain that throughout the season, you got to look back and realize how important that event was. I think it's also worth pointing out that he had kind of stolen it away or won it over Patrick Cantlay, who had come into this season, and this was his first start of the season, as the FedEx champion. I think it is kind of interesting that the two of them now mirror it and will be playing 1-2 in the FedEx Cup Championship or the Tour Championship this weekend. So I like it for a lot of reasons. I'll also throw in the fact that Sahith Theegala, the rookie that has made it to East Lake, he nearly won this event. He was that 54-hole leader going into that final Sunday. So there is some symmetry and there is some added storylines, but for what it did for Scottie Scheffler, that's why it's my favorite event of the year.
I love that symmetry, you know, synergy, kismet. I mean, those two, you know, we're going to see them, you know, battling it out in Atlanta. I mean, how about the season? You know, it's usually, oh, we all saw it coming, or the floodgates. I mean, no one, you know, we don't see floodgates open that often on the PGA Tour.
Scottie had shown some real promise last year, but once he got that win, it just, something clicked.
Yeah.
And he just became a slightly different player, and a little bit's a lot when you're that good.
Yeah.
And suddenly those close calls were victories. And, you know, it's amazing how quickly he won four of them.
Yeah.
And you feel like he's still got some in reserve because he's got so much game through the bag.
Yeah, and you wonder if it had gone the other way, he's still having to answer questions. When are you going to get that win? And maybe he doesn't win four times this season. How about for you? Favorite moment? A lot of high points.
A lot of high points. I always look at Jordan Spieth as a dramatic figure who does dramatic things. And when he won at Hilton Head, I thought it was dramatic because it had been a year since he'd won. He'd been through kind of a mini hell. He'd been through a bigger hell before that when he won at Texas Valero. But then when he won at Hilton Head, it's like he regathered himself again. And he did it without that club, as he said, without the putter. Mm. He was 60th in strokes gained that week, which I think was the highest for a winner in many years. But he was first in strokes tee to green. So Jordan's battle has been to be a better ball striker. Mm. So he doesn't play these rounds where everybody says, oh, he's so adventurous. He plays like Phil. He plays like Seve. He wants to play like Hogan.
Yeah.
And that week he did, and I thought he was really on to something. And it was an incremental, no question, increase in his confidence and his ability. But it didn't get him quite over the hump like I thought it might. Mm. But definitely it was really his high point of the year so far.
Patrick Cantlay also in the frame at Hilton Head as well. How much with Jordan is it emotional? Just in terms of, you know, watching someone's golf EQ and someone willing to share good, bad, and ugly. You said, you know, the way you feel watching Jordan Spieth, how much is that kind of a part of the equation in that being your favorite moment?
Well, I think he's an open book in terms of the way he's feeling, but I also think he's really a master of his own emotions. I really do. Mm. I don't think he's losing it out there like some people
think. Okay, interesting.
I think he knows when he's venting and when he's in control. He's just too good a player who's won too many times and handled big moments. I just think the expectations are heavy sometimes.
Yeah.
And the game is capricious, and he's lost a little bit of his ball striking consistency, and it's leaned on his putter a lot, and it's hard to maintain all that. But I'm a big believer in Jordan's mental game.
Yeah. Similarly, for me, it's Rory McIlroy in the way he handled the RBC Canadian final round 62, wire-to-wire win for a player who, let's be honest, at this point in his career, is playing for things larger than himself and, you know, being a spokesman for the PGA Tour and delivering messages subtle and obvious and kind of carrying that weight. And for someone who's, you know, motivation about his long career is going to ebb and flow. Mm-hmm. And the focus isn't always going to be there. His focus, especially toward the end of the year, it seems to be really laser sharp at this point and kind of being this PGA Tour spokesman in the face of this upstart and, you know, maybe no longer an upstart when you talk about LIV Golf. And Rory, to me, I watch him he makes me feel the way I do when I watch Jordan Spieth or Tiger Woods back in the day. I can't take my eye off of Rory McIlroy when he is in full flight. It's different. It's something to behold.
He's so gifted. He's also other-directed towards others. And right now he's playing maybe for something other than himself. And for most golfers, that wouldn't work. For him, it may.
Yeah.
But I also think that here's the clock ticking. And, you know, I got to make something out of my gift here in this last stage. Well, not last, or in my next stage of my career.
Yeah.
And he has gotten better. He's gotten better around the green and on the green, which is the most important parts that he had to improve.
Yeah.
So I just feel there's more focus towards achievement going forward. I think he can have it both ways. He can do something for golf at large, but mainly do something for himself.
Yeah, very introspective, but clearly highly motivated at this point in his career as well. All right, folks, when Golf Today returns, we check in on the latest news on the antitrust lawsuit filed by LIV Golf toward the PGA Tour. Our legal expert, Jody Balsam, joins the show and tells us what you need to know. Welcome back to Golf Today. A trial date has been set in regards to a lawsuit filed by LIV golfers, including Phil Mickelson and Bryson DeChambeau, against the PGA Tour. U.S. District Judge Beth L. Freeman has set a tentative date for summary judgment for July of 2023, with a trial date expected to begin January 8th, 2024, months later than some had anticipated. And as you know, it's been a very busy timeline since May, that initial LIV Golf field announcement, including Taylor Gooch, Matt Jones, and Hudson Swafford. The first LIV Golf event began in England on June 9th. That same day, the PGA Tour suspending players competing LIV Golf event. 11 players filed an antitrust suit against the PGA Tour. And you see the names, 11, now it's down to 9. The judge denying that TRO for Gooch, Swafford, and Jones on August 9th. And there you see that summary judgment hearing scheduled next summer, and then January 8th, 2024, the trial scheduled to begin. So great to welcome back Jody Balsam, sports law professor at Clinical Law, Brooklyn Law School. Jody, it's always great to spend some time with you during these complicated issues as well. Judge Freeman has set this trial date for January 8th, 2024. That's a long time from now. So what happens now?
Well, we learned three things from the judge's status conference last week. One is that the players, the LIV Golf players down to 9, are not going to pursue any form of preliminary injunctive relief between now and that trial date. So as you know, they sought emergency relief in the form of a TRO that would have covered just the FedEx Cup tournament. They were denied that relief. They still had the option of pursuing relief that would take them through the entire year and a half until trial and prevent the PGA Tour from excluding them from its tournaments. They decided not to do that. They decided to allow the PGA Tour to continue, or rather, not to ask the judge to stop the PGA Tour from excluding them from tournaments. So we've now got a year and a half period until the trial date in which the PGA Tour can continue to do business as it hoped it could by excluding anybody who is participating in LIV Golf tournaments. There will be no request by those golfers for interim relief. So that's a big concession by the LIV golfers. What comes along with that is an equally big incentive to move this case quickly to trial, because the sooner they get what they hope to be a trial ruling in their favor, the sooner they can resume playing for the PGA Tour. So what's going to happen between now and January 8th? So there are two things that we learned, two additional things we learned from the status conference last week. One, this trial schedule is still very ambitious. You may remember that the judge originally tried to schedule the trial for August 2023, and she was talked off that ledge by the PGA Tour's lawyers, reminding her that that is precisely when the tour hits one of its critical series of events, the FedEx Cup, and everybody who might testify at that trial, senior PGA Tour executives, top-ranked players, would be consumed by the FedEx Cup events and wouldn't be available for trial. That's one of the main reasons she moved the date back to January 2024. So what's the third thing we learned is what's going to happen between now and January 2024? There's going to be what is called pretrial discovery. That is, the parties in this lawsuit are allowed to request from each other documents and interviews with witnesses, known as depositions, to learn about the positions, the facts, the ecosystem of golf that would support or deny relief under the PGA, under the LIV golfers' claims. And that discovery can be very time-consuming and disruptive. And in fact, it is a very rare antitrust lawsuit that could get through the required discovery in as short a time frame as this judge has set forth. In fact, one of the lawyers in last week's status conference made the point that the average time to trial in the Northern District of California for a civil case is well over 2.5 years. So she's trying to do it in 1.5 years, and I wish her luck.
Jody, how much did the principles covered in the TRO that was successful for the tour, even though the judge said this is not the antitrust case at large and we shouldn't draw any conclusions about it having an effect, as, in your opinion as an attorney, will those same principles be important going forward as the trial starts to get scheduled?
Yes, absolutely. Those principles will be a key source of the kinds of questions and requests the parties make of each other in the discovery process. So the parties are now polishing off their document requests. They're going to ask for a range of materials from the other side that will help them explore the legal questions raised in that TRO hearing, including, is the PGA Tour monopolist? Have they exercised monopoly power in a way to exclude or undermine potential new entrants in the world of elite professional golf? What have the members of the tour and the executives who run it said to each other about the LIV Golf entry? Those individuals will all be deposed, that is, they'll be examined under oath in advance of trial to discover information that will either support or defeat those legal issues.
Well, to what extent is it possibly a microcosm of what's to come? What happened in the TRO?
So I would suggest that it's not predictive, that the level of discovery that you see in a typical antitrust case is so intense, so of such great magnitude, that we still don't know what the factual record will look like. Because an antitrust lawsuit is an inquiry into the operation of an entire industry, usually the documents produced are voluminous. Dozens of witnesses may be deposed before trial. There's a lot still to learn about what the PGA Tour did or didn't do in response to LIV Golf's entry. So it's very hard to say, based on some lawyers' arguments in a TRO hearing, whether there is merit to the LIV Golf players' claims.
Jody, the layperson following this story sees that the 11 plaintiffs is now down to 9. Any significance in that change?
Well, there's some significance in that it shows a reluctance to engage with an onerous, distracting, time-consuming litigation process. If you're a plaintiff in this claim, you will have to turn over personal documents. You will have to turn over your business documents. You will be deposed by the other side. In fact, having abandoned the lawsuit doesn't necessarily protect any player from that sort of inquiry, because a lawsuit like this will often generate requests for non-party documents. In other words, any other participant in the golf ecosystem who might have information relevant to this claim could expect to be subpoenaed for documents or even witness testimony. And one of the issues that was raised last week at the status conference is that a significant non-party here is the LIV Golf entity itself. And defendants' lawyers, the PGA Tour's lawyers, made the point that it's sometimes difficult to obtain non-party discovery from a foreign entity, that especially one that is a foreign government might put up roadblocks to PGA Tour getting information from that entity that it should be entitled to in an antitrust suit of this nature. One of the representations that plaintiff's lawyers made in that hearing is that they will ensure the LIV Golf and Saudi Investment Fund's cooperation with this litigation. We'll see if that actually happens.
Yeah, Jody, sometimes cases, you know, trials don't even reach a conclusion. Sometimes there's a settlement beforehand between the two sides. With so much time between now and the trial date, what is the likelihood, or is it completely unlikely, that these two sides would settle?
So often you see settlement negotiations incentivized by a ruling a court makes along the way to trial. There are still a number of pretrial motions that might be made by both parties to try to narrow down the issues in dispute. And if a judge carves out or dismisses part of the claims that were brought, it might incentivize settlement discussions. Another type of ruling that might incentivize settlement discussions is if the parties have disputes over what is discoverable and what can be kept confidential during the process of pretrial discovery. That might get the parties to the table. But I don't see serious settlement discussions happening here unless something radically changes in the way either party is doing business, or if we get some sort of interim ruling from the judge which changes the viability of the litigation.
Fascinating, unprecedented times in so many ways. Jody, thanks so much for your insight. We look forward to speaking to you soon.
Take care, guys.